CinemaSins has a fan club. It's called the Sin Club, and members get all sorts of things like early episodes, bonus videos, merch discounts, and even monthly bonus podcasts. Membership starts at $3 a month, and you can sign up now at patreon.com/CinemaSins.
And he goes, I need you on here on Friday. And I was like, Mark, I can't. And he says, you're meeting Chris Rock. And I was like, I'll be there in a minute.
Welcome to SinCast, presented by CinemaSins.
All right, everybody, welcome to the SinCast. This is Chris Atkinson from CinemaSins, joined by Jonathan Watkins from CinemaSins.
Hello, hello.
And Barrett Sher from CinemaSins.
Hi.
And today we have a very special guest. It is director Darren Lynn Bousman,
who
has done a movie called Death of Me, coming out October 2nd in theaters, VOD, digital. It stars Maggie Q and Luke Hemsworth. Many people out there may have heard this name from the Saw series, Saw 2, Saw 3, Saw 4, and there was supposed to be a Spiral coming out in May of this year, but then tragedy struck, and we had a pandemic, and now it's being pushed off into the, you know, the, well, we don't know when it's coming out, but I was looking forward to that. It looked like a lot of cool stuff going on in that.
It's coming out on May 21st, 2021, so
all right,
okay,
it sucks it was pushed a year. But you know, it's not worth going and possibly dying in the movie theater to see it. I mean, I love the movie, but maybe not enough to die for it, but it is pretty awesome.
I didn't know if you were going to change the tagline. It's a pandemic. It must be Saw, something like that. Yeah.
And then, you know, there are some others that you find people might know out there. And that is Repo: The Genetic Opera.
And, huge fan here, by the way.
And the sort of, I guess, spiritual follow-up, Alleluia, The Devil's Carnival. These movies are so fun, but I kind of want to go over, well, I just named a random hodgepodge of movies there, but how was it, what's it like, what was it like being on the Saw franchise? What was it like to sort of be the breath of life back into the new Saw and everything? Just tell us what that experience is like.
I mean, I have such a weird past with Saw and now future with it, or present. So when I got Saw 2, I'd never directed a movie in my life, and I was completely out of my element in Toronto, having no fucking idea what I was doing or when they were going to realize that I was a complete fraud. I did that, and then it ended up well for me, and I made a couple more, and then I got burnt out. By the time I made Saw 4, I was over it. And I think because it stopped being challenging for me, because the crew was so on top of things, the producers were so on top of things, that it almost felt like at times, if I showed up drunk or asleep or didn't even show up, the movie would still work and it would still be awesome.
Did you try it?
No. But so I said, you know, I need to step aside and I need to do something that is more challenging. And not that Saw wasn't challenging, but again, it was so well, the machine was so well oiled that I didn't feel integral anymore to it. Hmm. And that's a testament to the crew and the producers and the writers that it just worked so well. I left Saw and I said, that was it. I wasn't coming back. And I was an idiot, because I guess you should never say never, because here we are, I think 14 years later, 13 years later, something. Mm-hmm. I am back behind the camera, back in the universe with the same producers and a lot of the same crew that was killing it a decade ago. It was crazy to come back, because again, I never thought that I would be on that set again, working with those people. It was again, in a lot of respects, just like going back to Saw 2, because I felt like a fraud and I shouldn't be there. And I remember when I think it was day 2, Sam Jackson showed up, Samuel Jackson. And I'm standing on set in between, you know, Chris Rock and Samuel Jackson. And I was like, how the fuck did I get here? So
David Byrne moment.
Yeah, it was a pretty crazy experience coming back. And then, I'm so excited for people to see that movie. It's different, yet it still has so many similarities that diehard fans will love, but it's its own unique, entirely different thing.
That's really cool. So did Chris Rock actually, I can't remember what the story was. Did Chris Rock come to you or?
No, not really. So what happened was, I think Chris was at a party and he kind of made some offhanded joke to one of the producers that he liked the Saw movies and all they needed was a couple of jokes. And if they had a couple of jokes, it would be a whole new audience. And someone said, you know, they referenced that and said, well, you should come write one or something. Cut to a few years later, he had a take for a movie that I think he went in to pitch Lionsgate. And Lionsgate said, you know what? This is really interesting. You should talk to Mark and Oren about this, the producers of Saw. So Chris went in and spoke to Mark and Oren and pitched this idea. And they were like, holy shit, this is a Saw movie, Chris. I don't know if you realize you just pitched a Saw movie. So they went to Josh and Pete. And then Josh and Pete, the writers who wrote Jigsaw, got together with Chris. And they beat out a treatment and then eventually a script for the movie. Now, all this was happening and I did not know any of this. I was off in my own world doing my own shit. Cut to, I get a phone call one afternoon and I'm in New York. I had not moved, but I was in the process of moving to New York to do something that I'm really passionate about, which is direct theater. And I was offered an opportunity to direct this huge Broadway production. And so I'm literally, this could not have happened. It was the most crazy, just circumstantial, serendipitous thing. So I get the offer for this Broadway show and I'm texting my wife and I'm like, pack our bags, we're leaving, we're coming to New York, we're moving to Manhattan. And as I am talking back and forth with my wife, who's in LA, my phone rings and it's Mark Berg. And he goes, Darren, what are you doing right now? And I said, I'm in New York. And it was a long pause and he goes, I need you in LA. I said, I'm in New York, Mark. I can't just come to LA. And he goes, well, you need to be in LA because you have a meeting. And I think it was like the next day. I think it was Thursday and I had a meeting on Friday. And he goes, I need you on here on Friday. And I was like, Mark, I can't. And he says, you're meeting Chris Rock. And I was like, I'll be there in a minute. So I get sent the script on the flight home. I read the script. And it was awesome. It was so different than what I was expecting. It didn't feel like a Saw movie, but it felt like a Saw movie at the same mm-hmm. time. And then I sat down and Chris and Mark and Oren and I sat down for breakfast. And by the end of it, I was like, I'm in, let's do it. And so I turned down the Broadway thing. And, you know, 2 weeks later I was on a flight to Toronto.
Wow. Jeez. How does anything get done in Hollywood? Either it gets done immediately or never, right? There doesn't ever seem to be like an in-between, like, you know, this went through the normal process of a couple of weeks and then we got this guy on and everything. I always hear stories like this where get out here within 24 hours, you know?
Yeah, no, it's, there is the one thing I've learned about Hollywood. There is no, people always ask me like, how did I make it or how does it work? It feels like every time I do a movie, I'm completely flabbergasted at the process, how it got made, how it was completely different than what happened before it. This is just like that. The Spiral movie was from thinking I was moving to New York to doing another Saw movie a decade plus later. And in the process of literally hours was pretty crazy.
And then two of some of the most unique movies I've ever seen, Repo the Genetic Opera and Alleluia the Devil's Carnival. Are those movies as fun to work on as I think that they are?
Yeah, they are. I mean, so in both, so there's actually a third one in there that you need to watch that's an in-between of those. So The Devil's Carnival was its own thing, and then there was The Devil's Carnival Alleluia, which was a feature version, but there was a short film. When I say short, it was a 60-minute short of A Devil's Carnival before that. So there was one Repo and two Devil's Carnivals, and they are awesome, but what is not awesome about those movies is that the amount that is on the line making one. So like on The Devil's Carnival, I financed it. And, you know, when you're putting your own money into something, it's awesome because I have the ability to say fuck you to everyone. Mm-hmm. I don't have to listen and I can do whatever I want. But then there's also that thing that if this thing fails, I cannot blame anyone. Like it's on me. Like everything is on me. And those movies were all made, in my opinion, as a, I don't want to say as an F you to the system, because that's Repo. We all thought was going to be commercial. When we made Repo, it was made by Lionsgate. It was made by Twisted Pictures, who made the Saw movies. And I think the intention was this is going to be a huge thing. It was a colossal failure when it was first released. And I mean, it was so horrifically bad as a failure that there were moments that I believe Lionsgate was going to do me a favor and just bury it and let no one ever see it because it was so bad. And they tested the movie when Repo was done, and it tested for those filmmakers out there. When you finish a film, studios will take it to a, you know, a place where they consider it to be middle America, and they will pull people from every nationality, race, and age, and they will put them in a room and they will say, judge this movie. And then one of the most important things you look for is the numeric value on what they give your movie. Would they recommend it? Would they not recommend it? Would they come back and see it? All of this. I tested so poor on Repo the Genetic Opera that it was in the single digits. You want to be in the 80s, 90s. I think I was like one or two. Like it was so goddamn bad.
Wow.
Well, and again, part of the reason it was so bad was when they screened the movie, they didn't screen Repo. They screened a director's or an editor's assemblage with no music. So it's a musical, 50 songs. There was a click track in there. So of course it scored terribly. But anyway, the movie ends up just tanking. I think my career is over, and I fought to get this movie made. Like I literally, you know, I went to war to get that film made, and it was going to be relegated to the bargain bin at the last few blockbusters that were remaining. And I kind of got mad, and that's where my career changed. Is I got really angry, and I was like, "You guys are wrong. There is an audience for this movie. You guys tested a shitty version of it. Let me finish the music. Let me finish the visual effects. Let me finish the cartoons that are supposed to be in it. You're wrong." And so I went into Lionsgate and I said, I believe in this movie, even if no one else does. And I would like to ask for the print back. And because of my relationship with them, John Feldheimer who was the head of the studio, said, okay, I'll tell you what, you can have your 35mm print back, and we're going to go ahead and do, you know, what we do, which is the DVDs and VHSs and all that. I said VHS. That's how old I am.
Yeah.
So they continued to do what they were going to do, which was like put it in one screen or two screens, and they gave me the print. And so myself and my cohorts started calling movie theaters all across America. I think we ended up calling, I don't know, 200 or 300. And we got 50 to agree to let me four-wall it at their theater. And so I'd pay them, you know, some minimal amount of money, and I would be able to collect 100% of the ticket sales. And we got in a van, and we started driving. And we were probably in a van over the course of 100 days. And we four-walled it, and we built an army. And what would happen, which was amazing, was all these theaters had such a turnout and such a insane fans that would show up that the theaters would see it, and they called Lionsgate and would say, hey, we want to show Repo every week. And so Lionsgate started getting all these calls, and one theater turned into five theaters, which turned into 10, which turned into 100. And next thing we know, Repo starts playing every weekend all across America. And here we are, I don't know, 12 years later, 13 years later, and it's still showing, you know, throughout the United States and some places of the world. You know, at least once a month, sometimes twice or three times a month on double bills with Rocky. And it was awesome because to me, it was the proving that even bad movies that are considered bad have an audience. You just have to go out and find them. And so we were told there was no audience for Repo. I got mad. I said, fuck you, there is an audience. And we found them.
Yeah.
And so Devil's Carnival was our kind of answer to that, where we said, let's bypass all of the studio. Let's do everything ourselves. Let's write it. Let's cast it with who we want to cast. And let's go out and do this thing completely independently. And so when we made Devil's Carnival, that was the intention, was let's do it all ourselves. And we were able to. And that was an awesome experience because we were the studio in that respect. From the album to the marketing to the promotion to the posters, everything about it was us. And it was awesome to have that type of control. But again, you're banking a lot that it's going to be successful, because if it fails, you lose your house. And that's not like a normal movie.
See, that shows you what what I know, because when I watched these two movies, there's such a loose nature to how the story unfolds and everything. I actually thought to myself the opposite of what you just said, which is, you know, it doesn't seem like there's much on the line to make this movie at all. And
Repo was the most expensive at that time. I think we made it for, this might be wrong, but it was like $12 or $13 million. It opened in two theaters. I think it made maybe $5,000 opening weekend. So it was a huge failure. So you're only as good as how much money you're able to bring in. Mm-hmm. So from that standpoint, it was huge. Now, Devil's Carnival was a whole different thing because it was my money. And it was, you know, contrary to what a lot of people believe, Saw is a very profitable franchise, but I am not a very profitable person in the Saw universe. I'm just the director. I don't own it. James Wan and Lee own it, and the producers own it. Mm-hmm. So for me doing Repo, I mean, I put my house up. Devil's Carnival, I put my house up. So if it would have been a failure, I would have lost that.
Oh, wow. God. You went out there and Rudy Ray Moore'd it. You did the Dolomite treatment, huh?
Wow. It gives me an entirely new appreciation for that movie. Yeah. I mean, it's very, those both are really fun to watch, but I had no idea that you were that's doing a high wire act without a net there. Had no idea.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Darren.
No, go ahead. No, please.
I was just going to say, I remember when all the Repo talk was going on, and I think Brian Collins was probably where I first heard about it, because he was writing about it on Horror Movie A Day or maybe at Birth Movie's Death. I can't remember at this point. But and I think I talked to him on Twitter about it. I did not get to see it in a theater, unfortunately. I can't even imagine how great of an experience that would be. But I'm a huge rock opera guy, and that was probably the first movie of its type in at least 20 years, if not more at that point.
And I think that was my inspiration. I mean, I love, my favorite era of filmmaking was from like 1971 to like 1983, mm-hmm. where you had this insane, flamboyant, over the top rock operas that mm-hmm. were coming out. I mean, every single year, you know, from Jesus Christ Superstar to Tommy to Phantom of the Paradise to Phantom or to Rocky Horror Picture Show. I mean, they were to the Forbidden Zone. They were mm-hmm. so over the top in their flamboyancy that I wanted to make something that was kind of like that, which is that no holds barred, doesn't give a fuck about anyone type of musical. The seeing Repo in a theater though, or seeing Devil's Carnival was an event of itself. And that was what we tried to do, was we tried to make the experience as entertaining, if not more entertaining than the movie. So when we made Alleluia, it was made as an audience interactive thing, not necessarily the movie. So when we were writing the script and coming up with it, it was the thought of what happens in a theater was more important to us at that time than necessarily the subject matter of the movie was. So we designed it as a road show and a carnival. So if you would ever see one of our road shows, it was batshit crazy. I mean, we had jugglers and X-rated clowns and sword swallowers and,
oh my God, I want to go to this so bad.
Dancing women, and we walk into the theater. It was a R-rated carnival that kind of sandwiched the movie. So you came in and there was 30 minutes of insanity, and then the movie would show, there was an intermission with insanity, and then the movie would end, and then there was more insanity. And we were making it an event that happened to have a movie at it, as opposed to a movie that had an event. The event took forefront to everything, and the movie played during that. So the scene in the theater was such a different experience.
So kind of like Rocky Horror, right? Like it's a 180 from watching it at home. And
100%. It was in a lot of respects like being in a band, because we were in a different city every night. We were living on a tour bus. And some of the shenanigans that would take place, I mean, it was, there had to have been at least 5 or 10 times that I would turn to my compatriots and be like, are we going to get arrested for this? Like, is this illegal? it was pretty crazy. And I do have some of those crazy roadshow stories that you hear about bands. Like, I don't know if you guys have ever read The Dirt. We didn't get that bad on anything we did, but there were moments that we really thought we were going to be arrested, because when you're on the road for 90 days, shit, you just lose all grasp of reality and insanity. And I remember there was a moment that we flew Barry Bostwick out, and Barry Bostwick was joining us on the road for a couple of stops. And we had a long drive, and Terrence, who plays the devil in the movie, didn't tell any of us, but we stopped at a gas station, and he bought a shit ton of fireworks. And we arrived at the hotel, and we're checking in, and we're always at these seedy motels because we're paying for everything. And as we're walking to our door to get to the room, I just hear this fly past me, and Terrence had lit all the fireworks in the hotel, and they are shooting every single direction. And within a second, the fire alarms go off. And so all the fire alarms go off in this hotel. And I did what any sensible person would do in this situation. I screamed, I ran, I jumped in the car, and I fled. cut to us hanging out at a bar, like freaking out that we're going to get arrested. And we can just hear police and firemen in the distance. And we look out the bar, and there's got to be 15 fire trucks and 30 police and just insanity. And the best was, at that exact moment, Barry Bostwick shows up at the hotel after flying in to meet us there. And nothing happened in the hotel except the fire alarms went off and they heard loud noises. But Barry Bostwick is live streaming at that exact moment on his Instagram. And he's like, you get it. Something's happened. Something bad's happened. And I think it involves the boys. So that whole experience was unlike any movie I've ever been a part of.
I'm impressed Barry Bostwick was live streaming on Instagram. Like, that's an amazing story in and of itself.
I know. And that is one of the greatest things about those movies. If I got to work with my heroes. As a musical theater fan myself, if you go through the repertoire of people that I worked with on the Repo and the Devil's Carnival films, from, you know, obviously Sarah Brightman, Phantom of the Opera, but Adam Pascal, who originated the role of in Rent, to Ted Neely, who was Jesus and Jesus Christ Superstar, and still is. He's in his 70s now and still playing Jesus. Some insane heavy hitters in the musical theater world.
And Paul Sorvino, who I didn't realize I should have, because he busts out some pipes in Romeo and Juliet, but I didn't realize that he was a trained opera singer. And he's in both of those movies.
Yeah, he is. It's so funny because he is so much like his character God in that movie. It's not even funny.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Paul and I became very close over the years. I think we've made 3 or 4 different things together now. Mm-hmm. And he is a caricature of himself, and I love it.
I'm really curious, before we get off Repo, that what was working with Paris Hilton on that like?
Absolutely the opposite of what you would expect it to be like.
That's what I assumed. Yeah, I mean,
I've still to this day, I've never said one bad thing about her, because for me, she was. She was a delight. She showed up on time. She came prepared. She knew her lines. She promoted the movie. She had no entourage, and she rolled up her sleeves in moments that everyone else walked away. And I'll give you just one example, is that I was running over one afternoon, and the producers cut me off, and we were filming, and she was there, and they basically said, we're stopping this. You've gone over. And Paris says, how much over is he? And they said something like $60,000. I'm making this number up, but it was a lot. And she didn't say anything, and everyone went home for the day. And this was like on a Friday. And on Monday, she showed up and handed the producers a check for $65,000. And she went out that weekend and did a appearance in Toronto, where she gets paid an appearance fee, and just gave it to the producers and said, let them keep going.
Oh, wow.
And so, like, the balls to do something like that, like the ability. So she was great. I think a lot of what she is as an act, I think the thing that you see on TV and on the tabloids, it's an act. It's not the person that I saw.
I've always genuinely liked her and found her quite impressive. And I think she unfairly gets kind of lumped in with the Kardashians and other reality situations that came after her.
I agree.
So your new movie, Death of Me, how did you get on this project first? How did you get approached on this?
I am a friendly with the producers, Lee Nelson and David Tisch, who we've been trying for a few years to find something together. They're genuinely nice guys, and I have an issue of I want to work with people that I like. I don't want to work with people that just can get things made. So he came to me and said, we have this project called Death of Me. I read it. It was a much different script at the time. And it did, it was dealt with voodoo and a lot of things that we've seen before in the voodoo kind of space. I got on board with the project, and we started rewriting it to try to pull it away from things that we'd seen and set it in a more, I think, unique mythology that we had not seen. Mm-hmm. We did some research on it, and we found this basically story of what's called pillars, which are these hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years ago, they would bury women in the sand in the center of these towns as to basically protect the town and bring good health to the town. And there are a lot of legends around the fact that they would do it to pregnant women because they were the most powerful thing that you could bury. And so reading this mythology, we kind of based it all around that. And we started doing more research into that world. And we found, Thailand was such an amazing backdrop to set this in, the locations, the locale, the people. So it just kind of all like dominoes falling at that point. And it moved very, very rapidly.
Yeah, I was going to ask, you shot this definitely in Thailand, right? So what particular part of it did you film?
Yeah. So we went to two places. One is called Krabi, which is where you see the Airbnb and a lot of those gorgeous beach shots. And the other half of it was shot in Bangkok. And it was, it was a very unique experience. Very unlike anything I've ever done before. Shooting it guerrilla style, obviously, was very, very intense. We were rushing. It was probably the fastest turnaround on a movie I've ever done. But the elements was something that I wasn't prepared for. I mean, Thailand's one of the most beautiful places I've been, but from the heat to the massive mosquitoes to, and the heat, caused a lot of problems. So prosthetics, you're trying to put prosthetics on somebody and immediately those prosthetics sweat off. So there was a lot of production challenges that we were faced with in it, but we couldn't have asked for a better location.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
At first, when I started watching this, I was like, okay, this is like the horror version of The Hangover.
Yeah.
Because they're trying to reconstruct their steps from the previous night and everything. As you go along, the movie that really dominates this is The Wicker Man. I was just wondering how much did you set out how much influence does that movie have over this, or were you just trying to do a spin on it, or is it
if I could copy every second of The Wicker Man, I would.
So. Nice. I love that movie too.
That's amazing.
I The Wicker Man is one of my absolute favorite. It's like it is probably one of my favorite horror films ever made for numerous reasons. And they're definitely, there's definitely not only inspiration, but full on stealing from that movie. The idea that, what I loved about it was the town that the Wicker Man is based. Those are not evil people. They're not terrible people, horrible things. In their mind, what they're doing is completely justified. They're doing it for the betterment of their crops and their livelihood and their health. And so when you try to reason with that type of thing, it's so much more terrifying to me than dealing with a crazy person, because you're dealing with people that have children and they celebrate and they have love and they laugh. And to me, that is much, much scarier than dealing with psychotic people. Yeah. So I think that that's a huge influence that we took, is that when you look at belief in general, belief is a scary, fucked up, horrible thing in some respects, what people allow themselves to do based on faith and belief. Wars, death, killings, all of these things in the name of religion and what people believe in. And so I think that to take a approach like the Wicker Man does, which is, here is these group of people that ever so often there is a sacrifice that has to be made. And that's just the way of life. They're not doing it from evil purposes or nefarious purposes. That's just who they are and how they were raised. And it's a tradition that's been handed down. And so I always found that fascinating, because in this culture, in this story that we're telling, this is just who they are. It's not horrible. They're not mean people. This is just what they do to preserve the way of life that they have and to protect the ones that they love.
Yeah. And if you're somebody who just wanders into this world and you hear what they do and you find out, hey, this hasn't happened, or this is someone got healed when they did this or whatever, how are you ever supposed to tell them that it's just a coincidence, or if it, you know, or, you know, just some kind of, you know, random thing that you're trying to make, you're trying to make this religion based in fact somehow or whatever. I agree with you. It's like, so like, for have people who don't think that they're wrong in any way, that they're morally just and there's no sort of it's black and white to them, it is way scarier that way.
But I also love, some of my favorite moments in the movie have nothing to do with the organs being ripped out or eyes being stitched shut. It is the small moments of the town smiling at her, or yeah, bowing or hugging her. It's mm-hmm. that for them, that she is this great thing that's come to save their children and to save their elders and to save these things. And I think that to me is infinitely scarier than some of the supernatural elements, is that, you know, they truly appreciate what she's doing. And I thought that was, I think that's a really cool element of this.
Right off the bat, when you see the fishermen come up to the window, right as they're waking up, and you're like, oh, like Chris said, you know, oh, it's a hangover movie, that kind of thing. But then this out of nowhere local, he gets the fish and he's like, hey, how's it going? You know, and they're like, maybe something's a little bit off from this whole thing.
Yeah. And I think that when you rewatch the movie, you know, there are a ton of nods and hints towards that you could piece it together. An example, and again, major spoilers for those that have not seen the movie. If you go back and look at all those characters, from the guy handing the fish outside to the taxi driver to the Airbnb, they all have sigils and symbols around the place that is cult-like, that is following this belief of the thing. You know, the cab driver has it in his rearview mirror. The Alex Essos, who is the Airbnb owner, has huge paintings on her wall depicting the same thing, which is the necklace that Maggie is wearing throughout the entirety of it. So it's the belief of this island. And, you know, who are we to say that that belief is any more ridiculous than my belief that if my parents are sick, I pray to a God in the cloud to heal them. They both have this kind of supernatural belief to them. And, you know, just because we don't believe it doesn't make it crazy.
And adding to all of this is just the fact that, you know, I think this is something that, you know, a lot of people can relate to, is going to a foreign country, not knowing the language. And I don't know if this was a hard decision on your part or not to include subtitles or not. But not knowing what everybody's saying really contributes to your anxiety in this movie.
Yeah, that was a thing that I said very early on, that I literally wanted 90% of the movie to be in Thai and only 10% to be in English. Mm-hmm. we decided just to make it more accessible to not do that as much. But yeah, I didn't want any of the Thai subtitled, because again, the idea is you're a fish out of water, you're a stranger in a strange land. And so if Maggie's character and Luke's character could not understand what was being said, then the audience shouldn't understand what was being said. And ironically, one of my favorite like behind the scenes kind of in jokes is that everything that they're saying a lot of the times is so ridiculous if you would actually understand, like, purposefully. So like the doctor, she goes and sees the doctor, and the doctor gets into a fight with the nurse, and they're yelling at each other like really loud. They're only arguing about what they're having for lunch, not about anything to do with her. Because she's inconsequential. Like, they know what has to happen, that she has to take this stuff and she has to be brought up for sacrifice. So they're not talking about her. They're talking about these small mundane things, which again, to me, is even scarier as well, that she doesn't matter. Like, it's this argument that we perceive to be about her, but it's actually about something completely different.
Yeah. Maggie Q, I feel like, is someone that is underused in Hollywood. Like, I just don't feel like I see her enough. But of course, twice this year, I've seen her in island horror movies. What is it like working with somebody like Maggie Q? I'm sure it's as awesome as it sounds.
You know, it's funny is Maggie is the one person on set that I really didn't get a chance to hang out with at all. Maggie's in every single scene in the movie, every single scene. And we shot the movie out of order just to be able to make our dates. And it was, as I mentioned, a very rapid shoot. I think we shot the movie in, I want to say 20 days. And so since it was shot out of order, her makeup and her deterioration required her going back to the trailer. I mean, almost on an hourly basis, gone for 2 hours, and I get her for 30 minutes. So she was running back and forth between trailer and set so rapidly. So there was a lot of downtime waiting for her. So I became very close with Luke and very close with Alex. And Maggie was just insane, running from point A to point B, hoping to get this movie made in time. So it was a kind of weird experience. I've never had that with an actor. Usually you have downtime, you have, you know, drinks on the weekend, you have all of this. You know, one of the things that was that I really wanted when casting this was I wanted somebody that did not have a lot of baggage, meaning that they weren't the front page of TMZ all the time and had a bunch of weird kind of baggage with them. And two, someone that could do the role without playing the victim. And I think that's a very easy thing to fall into, is the victim mentality, that you're a damsel in distress. And I think that Matt's right. presence is much stronger than that. And so she was a great get for us. Also really, 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 really loved working with Luke and Alex. Alex, I'm a huge fan of, if you guys have not seen Starry Eyes, which she's the star of, it was a horror film years back. She's fantastic in that. I've been a fan with her for a long time. And then Luke, who I am, again, he will be in numerous projects to do from this point forward. I just had such a, because Luke had a lot of downtime, because he's, you know, he appears in the movie and then disappears in the movie, but he was there the entire time. So Luke and I, you know, there'd be many, many drunken nights, you know, in Thailand, which was awesome. So it was a really fun shoot in that respect.
Okay, cool. Because now you've got to do us a favor. You got to give us a flaw with a Hemsworth brother. I mean, there's got to be something. there's got to be a weird mole.
No, and it's funny because an ongoing joke would be is that I would always fire him and be like, "Can I just get another Hemsworth brother in here?" No, he was great. And you know what's crazy about him is he lives in Australia. Mm-hmm. And if you go to his Instagram page and you look at any of his Instagram videos, those are all things in his backyard. So like, he has a video that he put a couple of weeks ago that it's him in his backyard sitting at the table. And there is a huge, huge snake, and it's either a boa constrictor or a python. I'm terrible with what snakes exist in what regions, eating a bat hanging from his tree. And it's insane. Or he's got like ginormous tarantulas the size of my dogs, like eating apples. Or this, like, today he posted something. I mean, they're just the most ridiculous outdoorsy, like mountain man type of shit that I've ever seen, that I would have moved, and that would have been enough for me to just never return. And he's an interesting guy.
And then Barry Bostwick is in those Instagram videos as well, right?
he's the one actually live streaming those videos.
I looked over Luke Hemsworth's filmography and I was like, man, this is really the first movie I've seen him in. He was in Thor Ragnarok and he had that, you know, cameo appearance that was really funny. But I had not seen him in anything else. What's the show he's on?
Westworld.
That's right. I've seen, I think I've seen the first season of Westworld. I'm not sure if he was on the first season,
he's in and out of it. I think you're going to start seeing a lot more of him. It's one of those things that I mentioned that I love working with people that are just fun, because movie making should be fun. We're not curing cancer. We're doing fun make-believe. And he's such a fun person to be around that, like, he's one of those guys that I will cast again and again just because he takes his job seriously. He comes to set prepared. He's good at what he does, and he's just a fun guy to hang around with.
Yeah, there are a couple of favorite moments I have, not getting into spoilers, but Maggie Q, her drunk scene when we're first seeing what happened to them.
Yeah.
Everything. I don't know if she's actually drunk or not, but if she's not, it's the best. It's one of the best drunk scenes I've ever seen.
Answering that.
Yeah. Oh, I'm not trying to get you to say. No.
She's fantastic. And I'm glad you said that about the not being a damsel in distress. Very much following the Wicker Man model of like being defiant. She can do the fucking just absolutely as well as anybody. And by that, I mean, say the word fucking. Like she'll just gear up for it. Like she'll look through a person. She'll be like, where is my fucking phone?
Yeah, she's
so great.
Very few people terrify me, and she's one of the people that actually terrify me because I know she can kick my ass. And, I mean, I don't know if you've seen her TV show where she's just a badass and that, but she's not someone that you want to piss off. And I think you could read that in the movie. The script or the original edit was a lot harsher with her relationship with her husband. One of my favorite movies I was attached to for many years, and then I ended up leaving it, was the remake of Children of the Corn. And what I loved about the original book, if you go back to the novella, is they hate each other. The husband and wife in the original novella of it, they do not like each other.
Oh my God. It's like, it's just crazy.
And he like leaves her for dead. Like there's moments where they try to fuck each other over and like put them out as sacrifices to these kids. I loved that idea originally, that Maggie and her husband were not only at odds with one another, but did not like each other. And we ended up taking that back considerably in the edit because we wanted people to sympathize. And I think that it used to be in the early drafts of the script, and even in the first few days of shooting, it was a lot harsher than that. And so we had to cut and kind of take her original kind of demeanor to her husband down a little bit in the edit. But originally she was intense because in the backstory, he cheated on her and she was venomous, and we had to go in and try to lighten it up because it was just too much. But it showed me, don't ever piss off Maggie Q.
I have not seen Starry Eyes, but I did see Alex Esso as Wendy Torrance and Dr. Sleep. And, I thought she was perfectly cast there, but, tell us more about her, because I feel like we're going to see her a lot.
So she's one of those down to earth people that has no baggage. She's just cool. She's a cool person. And I think that role was important for us because one of the things that we wanted to do was I was concerned about being offensive to the point of, here's this island that's bringing in Westerners and killing them, which I didn't want to make that movie. So we started talking about how do we cast this in a way and do this in a way that it's not that movie. And so if you go back and look at it, a lot of the perpetrators of the violence are Westerners. Whether it be Alex Esso's or the guy at the diner or the outdoor beach cafe that are doing this thing. So we wanted it to basically be not a island thing, but it is a religion that multiple people believe in. So that it started with that. And then we were trying to think of who could play sweet, who could play disarming. And there's just something interesting to me about Alex. Like, she's interesting on camera. And, I just really, really dig her a lot. And yeah, she was great as Wendy Torrance. Like, that was fantastic.
I have seen Starry Eyes as well. I agree with you 100%. That's a great performance.
She's amazing. She's next level on that.
Also Kelly B. Jones. I don't think I had seen her before this, and she was great. She was I don't know if maybe enchanting is the word, but she definitely grabbed my attention every time she was on screen.
Well, I'll tell you something. I mean, she's from Thailand, and I'll tell you one of the things that was crazy about that role. So, as I've mentioned now 15 times, we had such a limited amount of time to shoot this, and so one of the things that became very concerning to me is the language barrier. And there was a massive language barrier working in Thailand. And I've worked in, you know, I did a TV show in Japan. I did a TV show or did a movie in Barcelona. And having that language barrier slow things down considerably. But complicate that by the fact that most of the people that we were hiring out of Thailand spoke zero English, and they were doing a lot of improvising. So originally we cast that role as somebody else, and it was somebody that I came in and I met with, and she auditioned and she sounded great. And that character had to be able to speak both English and Thai. So she came in, she did the audition, she was fantastic, and we showed up on set the first day. And on the first day, we tried to change some things around, and we realized right away that she did not understand English, and she learned everything phonetically, and she couldn't do it. And the next afternoon, she had a 5-page monologue, and we realized we're fucked. And so I quickly called the casting directors. And I said, I can't, this actress is great, but she's not going to work for this movie. I can't frenetically have her do 5 pages of monologue. It's going to kill us. And they said, we've got this great Thai actress named Kelly. It's Kelly Jones. You got to meet with her. So Kelly came in and she was just fantastic. And she's got that, she's got such a unique look. She's got this very exotic yet educated look that I just loved. So yeah, she was fantastic.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I love your idea about keeping the Thai language unsubtitled, but it frustrates me to no end that we don't hear what the doctor says to her right before a certain event. It's almost like Lost in Translation, not knowing what Bill Murray says to Scarlett Johansson. I was like, what? I don't know what is going on here, but I guess that adds to the suspense.
Something fun about those scenes, like that scene with that doctor and her, all the people you see, I would say 75% of the Thai actors were people we found on the street and people that we found in the little villages and communities around there because they had such a unique look. And it to me brings an authenticity about it and an excitement about it. And it was such a unique place. Bangkok is specifically is a unique place that that where the doctor's place is. I don't know if you remember, but it's on like a dock, and that is all real. And that community lives like that, where they basically live on the water, and each one of these little environments they live in and work out of. And so we would go there, and I would just find these incredible people, and we would say, hey, do you want to be in a movie? And they would come, and we would teach them the lines or kind of what we wanted them to do. And it was something that would never happen in America. That was a great thing about working in Thailand.
You've said this several times about having to film it fast, and you shot it guerrilla style.
Yep.
Tell me what that's like. Are you saying that you had to shoot this without permits and stuff like that?
What are permits?
Oh, right. Yeah, I don't know what those are.
No, it's different. It's just different than it is shooting something in America. You're not dealing with the same union kind of restrictions that you would be in America. We would have to have permits kind of, but it's not like an American permit. It's so kind of hard to explain, but more importantly than government things, you would have to go and ask the community, and the community would have to agree, and then you'd have to get 2/3 of that community to agree to let you shoot in that place. There was something that I've never had to deal with before, which was a someone from the government had to actually be on set every single day. And I don't want to call – maybe they are a censorship board. I'm not sure what you would call them. But they would basically – had a huge book, and they would open the book as you shot things, and they would check their rules and regulations to make sure that what you were shooting was deemed accessible. Hmm. And there were acceptable. There was one moment that we had an issue, and it was the scene where what they're watching on the video where they're having sex. Mm-hmm. That was told that we could not do that because it was fornicating in front of a temple. Temple's a holy thing. And we had it framed in a wide shot. We had to change the camera angle to remove part of the temple behind them.
Oh, weird.
Yeah, so I've never had to deal with something like that, which is absolutely crazy. But regarding the guerrilla style, it was Bangkok in particular was very, very hard to move around in. The traffic was unlike anything I've ever seen before, where an hour, if you could be 1.3 miles away, and it could take you 3 hours to get there, easy, due to the back-to-back traffic. So by the time you would arrive to set, by the time that you were out of makeup, you might only have 7 hours to film. And that would require, you know, get one take, move on, and just hope you got it. So it wasn't like Spiral where you shoot it until you get it right. It was you shoot it once and you hope it worked and you move on and you hope you could fix it in post if it didn't work.
Oh, wow. Goodness gracious.
So you found worse traffic than L.A.?
Oh my God, LA was a breeze compared to Thailand.
Nobody has ever been happy to get back to LA traffic.
When I first arrived in Thailand, the first trip out there, the car came and picked us up at the airport, and we had a meeting that we had to be at like 6 o'clock, and it's 4 o'clock, and I look and I use my maps on my phone, and it says it was like 1.2 miles away, and the driver said, you know, I recommend you guys get out and walk. And we're like, get out and walk. And he was like, "At this traffic, it's going to be 3 hours easy."
Oh my God.
And we actually got out and had a walk. So we walked to the hotel a mile, like 1.2 miles. We had the meeting. And when the meeting was ending, that car was pulling up with our luggage. We just gotten through. It's that bad.
Oh, wow.
Oh, man. That's, I mean, it's a nightmare, but I bet the challenge of it. Was it at least a little bit fun, just the challenge of it, or
absolutely not?
No, Thailand.
No, listen, the experience of getting to shoot in a beautiful place like Thailand and work with the crew was awesome. Was it fun? No, because it was one of, you didn't have time to have fun. It was so, the schedule was so hectic and so crazy. That the moment you wrapped, you got drunk and fell asleep and just. Most of the evenings was me crying myself to sleep with a bottle of vodka or tequila or not. Because it was just so, it was so intense. And I also was really sick when we were filming it. I ended up at the very end getting, I thought at the time I got something called dengue fever, which is a mosquito borne illness. It ended up being a parasite that I am sure I got out of drinking a pina colada. I got a street pina colada once, which was a bad idea. I should not have done. And I started having probably the worst sickness that I've ever had in my life. Cut to me losing 18 pounds in about 6 days, 7 days. I thought I was dying. I actually called my wife. And I was like, I don't know if this is, I don't think I'm okay. And that was so my experience was complicated by this parasite illness. But you know, it was an intense shoot, but it was also amazing and awesome to be there in the culture and the landscape and the scenery of what Thailand offered.
Well, what do you have next that you can talk about? Anything that you can talk about at all?
Yeah, I've got, the thing I'm really excited about I'm doing right now is I've got a Halloween experience. So I, for those that don't know, I'm huge into what's known or called immersive theater, which is basically theater that you interact with. If you've ever seen the movie, The Game, the David Fincher film,
yeah.
I do that, you know, where people sign up and we fuck with their lives.
No.
And 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We have hundreds of actors and it takes place in the real world. And so for 4 years, I've been working on this thing called the Tension Experience, which is, if you Google it, you can read all about it. It is a extreme narrative that takes place in the real world and you are the star of it. it ended up that I sold that project to the Russo brothers, who directed a little independent film called Avengers.
Right. Right. I remember that. I think I saw that somewhere.
Yeah. And they partnered with us on the immersive side of it, and they are setting it up as a live show in Vegas. But my next film that I'm doing is the Tension movie. It's called Tension, which I start in 2 months, which is exciting. But every year I do an immersive event. Well, now the pandemic has hit. I didn't want to break that streak, so we're still doing it. It's just online, and it's called One Day Die. And if you want to look for it, you can go to www.onedaydie.com. And what it basically is I've partnered with a few magicians who I'm huge fans of, and it is a show that takes place in your home, but we send you a box in the mail, and you get a link, and you will watch a 90-minute thing, and you participate with what's in the box. But what's in the box is terrifying and horrific.
Oh my God.
You can sign up, you can get a ticket for it. It's called One Day Die. Tickets go on sale tomorrow. But the website is up and you can read all about it there. So I'm doing that right now. And then obviously this movie comes out on October 2nd, and then Spiral on May 21st.
Wow.
So, and for those of you,
a busy man, my friend.
Yeah. Yeah.
And for those of you listening, when he says tomorrow, that's September 15th, because I don't know when this podcast is going to come out, that sounds awesome, man. That sounds like something that's right up my alley, and maybe not at the same time. I'm not sure. I want to experience this in some way.
This one is much more accessible than some of the other events I've done. I've done a lot of these events that are very, very extreme. This one is created to be more accessible and more commercial than some of my more extreme events.
Well, yeah,
when you get back to doing it live, I know what these guys are getting for their Christmas gifts.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, I've read about, people talking about their experience and stuff in the past with some of those. And I'm one of those horror movie fans that's not really into like haunted houses and stuff. So I don't know if I have the balls to do it, but
I've been to a lot of haunted houses and a lot of extreme haunted houses. This could not be more different than that. There's no mask, there's no blood, there's no one jumping out and screaming at you. It's not that. Mm-hmm. It is a literal mystery murder thing that you are
and
you have to solve. But instead of watching it, you are doing it. You are going to the bar and talking to the bartender. You are going to the warehouse and looking for clues. You are getting in cars with the serial killer who's you are a central character in a real world mystery. That you form relationships with, and these events could take anywhere from 4 hours to 4 months, depending on.
Jeez. I take that back. That sounds right up my alley. So,
Death of Me comes out on October 2nd. Theaters, VOD, digital. We'd like to thank Darren Lynn Bousman for giving us his time. This was an illuminating conversation. I'm very happy we got to talk to you. Mm-hmm. Thank you for coming on today.
Great. Thank you guys so much.
And that's going to do it for this interview. It's Chris Atkins and Jonathan Watkins and Barrett Scher. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening. Comment on our episodes on our SoundCloud page. Check us out on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Reddit. And be sure to visit CinemaSins.com.